Thanks for tuning in for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Before we jump into today's interesting topic, unfinished business from yesterday. You recall we did an election recap with USU political science professor Damon Kahn. And as a part of that program, I opened the phone lines and the email and asked for your reaction to the election. And during that program, we had a phone call from Jennifer who expressed representative of some millions of people. She said she was sick to her stomach about the results of the election and the re-election of Donald Trump. We received an email yesterday evening, and this expresses, the other side of that coin. This is from Rob Roy. He says, I woke up Wednesday morning fearful and full of dread, remembering what happened overnight during the 2020 election. Not knowing the results of this election filled me with trepidation. Turning on the local news relieved me of all fearfulness. Such a feeling of relief, like warm water poured over my body. I truly believe had Kamala Harris been elected, it would have been the end of the United States as we know it. Thank heaven Donald Trump has another opportunity to bring us back from the brink of disaster. Let's hope he does as well this round as he did last time around, with help of his party on doing the right thing for American citizens. I'm sure we'll be back on track to prosperity. Thanks, Rob Roy. So thanks for that, Rob. And keep those emails coming on this or any of our topics, upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Welcome now to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with representatives of the group Via Rio Grande. They're proposing a citizen-driven vision for removing railroad crossings, revitalizing a neighborhood, and reusing the historic Rio Grande Depot as Salt Lake City's main transit hub. To make this project possible, they're proposing a train box for downtown Salt Lake City. It's a big concrete box dug down into the ground that's big enough to hold multiple railroad tracks. We'll be exploring all aspects of this project today. We'll be talking with representatives from the group, and we bring in Christian Lenhart. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And Nathan Strain also joins us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me start with you, Christian. Give me a little bit about your background. I know you're an engineer. What else?
That's right. I'm a civil engineer. I moved to the state of Utah to attend university to graduate as a civil engineer, and I got started on projects here right away, because there's a lot to build here in Utah. I've been involved in everything from small bike lanes around the Liberty Park and Salt Lake City area to the UVX bus line down in Provo to new freeway projects around the state. And I focus mostly on roads and transit that way, but I've got a passion for trains. And that led me to look at what improvements could be made downtown if we were to follow the best practices of civil engineering profession, what other cities are building around the country.
All right, great. Nathan Strain, tell me a little bit about yourself.
I'm a graduate of Utah State University with a degree in environmental studies. I moved to Salt Lake City for work a year ago and very shortly after got involved with this project. I see it as a means to help clean our air and to help improve mobility around the state.
All right. Very good. Maybe we'll start with you, Christian, on this question. What are the problems you're trying to solve with this big project?
Well, there's a few big problems with downtown, the transit situation downtown. One is the Central Station. It's not a very appealing transit station. There's not much to Salt Lake Central Station. It's more of a transfer point to get from one type of train to a different type of train on your way to downtown. The amenities aren't so great. The location is worse than the amenities in that it's far from downtown. It's without it's outside of the walking distance to get there. In order for the trains to get to that location, they have to go through multiple grade crossings. That's where they close the street and the train goes through. That slows down the train traffic. It slows down road and pedestrian traffic on the surface streets. And every single year since we've pitched this plan, there have been fatalities at these railroad crossings, which shuts down the transit service and the streets. Obviously, the loss of life is terrible. And the train tracks also make necessary big freeway overpasses to get into downtown, and those extend beyond the rail yards all the way to Fifth West. And it's that creates sort of a maze of pathways to get to the central station, and makes the area less accessible and very hard to get to from a pedestrian and transit rider point of view. So it's just it's less than ideal. The Rio Grande plan is a way to have a historic building that was purpose-built as a train station to be our train station again. It's a way to remove these grade crossings and make the streets safer, make transit more efficient and faster. It's a way to remove big bridges and reclaim the neighborhood and the street grid for what it could be, the way it was before the freeways and the railroads came in and kind of, well, tore up the street grid. So it's a way of healing communities again. The biggest thing, though, is that because these freight trains and these commuter trains block the crossings so frequently, is that the connection between the east side and west sides of Salt Lake City are getting slowly cut off by these railroad crossings. More trains that are added means that there's less ways to get between the east and west side, and that's a really big deal, socially, economically, politically. By removing this huge barrier of the railroad corridor and putting it in a great separated structure, we can go a long way to healing the east-west divide. And so all these benefits come by using the Rio Grande Depot again as a train station, which is why we have our name Via Rio Grande. You want better transit? It comes via Rio Grande. If you want better east-west connections, that also comes via Rio Grande. And we can keep going on that. But those are the main problems we're trying to address.
I want to follow up with you, Kristen, before I go to Nathan. So I guess historically, Rio Grande, that was the main depot. It was just the train station there. So was it freeways? Was that to it? How did it get so complicated and this maze and this barrier?
Yeah, so the Rio Grande Depot was built in the 1910. It's right at the end of 300 South, also called Broadway. It was a major street when it was a major train station, so it was called Broadway Street. Ironically, because the train station is at the right in the middle of 300 South, that blocks one of the main paths to get to Salt Lake Central Station, the main intermodal hub. So it's one of the barriers that was created. Obviously, it wasn't created to be a barrier. The station was meant to be the train station, but when that got moved a block and a half to the west, the train station by default became a barrier to accessing the new train station. That's such a ironic situation. The reason the tracks are moved is because of the freeways. So in order to get the freeways into downtown, they had to consolidate the railroad corridor into a single right of way. And so they moved all the tracks to the west, which meant that you couldn't use the Rio Grande Depot anymore. And it also meant that these big bridges came down right around where the train stations are. So it was a combination of two things, mostly the freeways, and that the necessitated the moving of tracks and the introduction of new bridges. But it's also the fact that the railroad crossings do go very, very close to downtown at grade, which is something that's unusual for a downtown of our size to not have any sort of grade separations on the surface streets like that. So I'll say it's a combination of multiple things that are causing this situation today. But the main solution to it is led by the railroad.
So Nathan Strand, tell me more about this divide. This is, as Christian Leonard has described this, the result is increasingly east side, west side are divided, and that brings problems, especially for the west side.
Yeah, so the east-west divide in Salt Lake City was largely introduced when the train tracks arrived in 1869 to downtown Salt Lake City. Now, from then, it has grown. So the tracks themselves fundamentally divided the city, but then very shortly thereafter, the freeway came in, or not very shortly thereafter, in the mid-1900s. I-15 was constructed, and that exacerbated this divide. And as we go today, these trains are going to be increasing in frequency. So Front Runner came in 2008 and increased mobility for everyone across the state, but also greatly increased the number of trains through these crossings downtown from, a freight train every hour or so, maybe every 30 minutes on a busy day, to trains every 15 minutes when you're considering both directions of traffic. And as we look to the future, of course, UTA and UDOT are planning to double the frequency of the front runner trains, which is going to be amazing for mobility and going to be amazing for public transit and get a lot of cars off the road. But at the same time, it's going to increase the number of crossing activations at these 8 downtown crossings from around 400 a day, which means that the crossing arms at the railroad crossing go down and then the crossing arms at the railroad crossing go up. They will go up to somewhere near 800 a day estimated with new frontrunner service and more freight trains. So the east-west divide is something that has sort of continued to grow since it was first created, and we're looking to reverse some of that.
Yeah. So Christian Lenhardt, I want to get to the really cool part of this, train box. Tell me what a train box is.
All right. Well, from a civil engineer point of view, we would call it a trench because it's a box that's dug into the ground. So basically you have these walls on the side of it. You dig just straight down, you create this open space. It's like like a trench, I guess. We were advised by a friend of mine who's an architect, say, don't call it a trench. Nobody likes that. We'll call it a box because that describes better what it looks like. So if you were to be in this thing, looking straight down, it would have a rectangular shape like a box. You'd see the two walls on either side of you. And you can put a roof on it as well. So even though the trains would have their own space below grade, it's not a tunnel. Tunnels are expensive. Tunnels are when you have the unmanaged earth on around it, so you have to build structurally in all directions. In a box situation, you have to build structurally only in the two, just side to side. And so that is a way to reduce costs. If you've ever been to Reno, Nevada, their railroad goes straight through downtown as well. And in 2005 to 2008, they lowered the tracks, just to say they pushed them down deeper into the ground using a train box, a covered trench, the same way that we would propose doing here. Their box is about 2 miles long, and it's removed 12 at-grade crossings in the downtown area. And so now if you go to Reno and you want to cross the railroad tracks, often you don't even know the tracks are there because you go across on either a bridge or you know, the nice pedestrian plaza. And, buses can go across because there's no more railroad activation events like Nathan was talking about. In Salt Lake City, UTA buses avoid railroad crossings because it creates unreliable schedules and danger of just being in the railroad crossing when a train's approaching. And so bus routes have to go around these railroad crossings here in Salt Lake City, which is another way the east-west divide is exaggerated. So with a train box, basically all the streets above get to be knit together again. It's like a complete street grid again. Because of this way of just lowering the tracks down using walls and a floor made of reinforced concrete. It's really cool to look at, and it's fantastic to see these trains just zooming, like gliding through downtown Reno and having the street life on top be completely unaffected, and life goes on as normal up there.
Let me make sure I understand. So it's not a tunnel. It's a trench, but if you lower the tracks, take them down by I don't know how many feet, you could put streets over the top.
That's exactly it. Mm-hmm. So the tracks go push down deeper, and the way you do that, there's retaining walls on the side. The distance it goes down is between 30 and 40 feet, and then the roads on top, they look like bridges, structurally they are bridges, and you can build a roof on the top as well. But like I said, yeah, it's not a tunnel. Tunnels are expensive. It's kind of a dirty word in engineering because the price just goes up significantly. And for good reason. Tunnels are complicated and often very restrictive structures. But a trench that structurally has very close to the surface, think of it more like a basement. We're building a basement for the trains to be in. And the street on top would be like the roof of a parking garage. These are structures that anyone knows how to build. It's not specialized construction like a tunnel. Anyone can build a basement, and parking garages are already enormous. Like if you were to take the Wells Fargo building in downtown Salt Lake, it has a parking garage. And if you were to stretch it out, unfold all the corners, it's a mile long already. And the train box that we propose in Salt Lake City is about a mile and a half long. So it wouldn't even be the largest structure in downtown Salt Lake City. There's already bigger ones. But just to say that this isn't something well within the means that Salt Lake City is able to build. It would be in size about the same or even shorter than what our neighbor to the west, Reno, Nevada, already built. You know, if they can do it, why can't we?
Right. Nathan Strain, so example, Reno, Christian mentioned Reno. I guess another example would be Los Angeles has a 10-mile one, train box.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So they have these two very major seaports, Los Angeles and Long Beach. Lots of container traffic moves from there. And the railroads do their classification of these trains near downtown. So the only way to get from the ports to these railroad classification yards is through something called the Alameda Corridor. And so they have about 10-mile long below grade train box, just like we're proposing here. Ours is about a mile, mile and a half long. Theirs is 10 miles. And they did it just for freight trains. We in Salt Lake City also have a similar problem where our inland port is to the west. It's sort of by the international airport. And we have two classification yards, one on the north and one on the south side of Salt Lake City, or downtown Salt Lake City. So as this freight moves from the port to the classification yards, it goes straight through downtown. And, you know, in Los Angeles, they solved that problem of multiple big trains downtown by lowering them. We suggest the same thing because, you know, as freight traffic increases, as the inland port is built up, and as freight train lengths increase, going through the slow curves downtown is just going to block crossings for a much longer amount of time. You know, the average length of a Union Pacific mainline freight train today is over 2 miles long. And that's the average length of a freight train. Imagine one of those 2 miles long creeping through downtown Salt Lake at 20 miles per hour. You're going to be stopped at the crossing for a very long time, and to have many more of those per day as the port grows, it's just going to be unsustainable to the traffic downtown.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I'll start with Nathan Strain on the first question after the break, and we'll get to started talking about what this train box would allow, right? What the project is, what kind of some exciting aspects of that. You're listening to Access Utah, and we're talking with representatives from the group Via Rio Grande. They're proposing a citizen-driven vision for removing railroad crossings, revitalizing a neighborhood, reusing the historic Rio Grande Depot as Salt Lake City's main transit hub. And we're talking with Christian Linhart and Nathan Strain from Via Rio Grande. More following this break. Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Christian Linhart and Nathan Strain from Via Rio Grande. They're proposing a vision for that area of Salt Lake City, removing barriers which separate west and east side, removing railroad crossings, revitalizing that neighborhood, reusing the historic Rio Grande Depot as Salt Lake City's main transit hub. I'll start with Nathan Strain here. So, Christian Linhart, described this train box, which would put the trains in the basement, as it were, and then you could run streets over the top. That would remove a lot of the barriers, right, between east and west. So give me kind of a scope of this project. I guess one thing that is envisioned is that Rio Grande Depot could become a major transportation hub again. UTA might move forward with new light rail service. It would also open up about 76 acres of land for redevelopment. So maybe start chewing on that, and then we could have Christian have a crack at that as well.
That's one of the great things about this project is it's just such, it's not one specific benefit for the cost. It is just an absolute bucket load of different things that are achieved. So we've already talked about addressing the east-west divide in Salt Lake City. Of course, moving on to the depot, having a better train station for downtown is critical. We like seeing other cities in this country that have revitalize their beautiful historic train stations. Denver is probably the closest example of that. And Denver's project is similar to ours in another way. They similarly redeveloped an old rail yard adjacent to the station, Theirs, of course, was 19 acres. Ours is about 76 acres. And their project was completely paid off by the return on this redevelopment in about 7 years, I believe. Christian could correct me on that. But that redevelopment potential of 76 acres in the downtown core of Salt Lake City is, that's a generational opportunity. 76 acres downtown for new housing, new parks, new businesses, whatever the city wants to do with it, is not an opportunity that presents itself on a regular basis. And it also presents a unique opportunity to invest in a project that actually will have a real payoff. We often see the state of Utah investing significant amounts of money in freeways and gondolas and other very expensive transportation projects. And we, you know, rarely ask how they're going to pay for themselves. And the state does it as a service because, you know, people want better roads and better bridges. And this project greatly improves the transportation situation in more than one way. But at the same time, it also will spur development with a greater economic return than the cost of the project. And that's really an absolutely undervalued aspect when people learn about this project. Of course, having the beautiful historic train station will be a pride. It'll be the pride of our state. It'll be the front door to Utah for everyone arriving in on a train, either from rural parts of Utah on potential new state corridor Amtrak service, or from long distance, someone showing up from the West Coast to see the Olympics in 2034, arriving at a grand train station instead of the concrete plaza that is Salt Lake Central.
So Christian Lenhardt, I want to have you say anything else you want about this, but starting with, okay, we'll put the train in the basement in this train box, and that'll remove some of this divide, right? But don't we still have freeways? Isn't it still kind of a maze of kind of confusing maze there? How's that going to get resolved?
Right. So, like Ethan was saying, there's about 70 some odd acres of land that are below the railroad yards. The railroad yards on the west side of downtown are kind of a relic of how railroads used to operate, how there used to be a lot of different warehouses in the area, and people would carry bags off the trains and into these warehouses, and they had to be spread out right in the downtown area where people lived, because that's also where they worked. The railroad industry is modernized, and things don't work the same way. There's not a lot of warehouses needed, especially right in the downtown area. The railroad classification operations have moved to two railroad yards north and south of downtown. So the area of railroad yards on the west side of Salt Lake City is mostly used for just extra car storage. And that's not a use that needs to be downtown. So if we were to take those railroad yards, which are empty space, and take the mainline tracks, put them in the basement, well, you don't need all that space for trains anymore. You've created new space for the through trains, the train box, the basement, and they don't need the yards. So you take the big bridges that go over the rail yards, you don't need those either. So the freeway exits can be like a normal exit. It takes you right onto the surface street. Now, the freeway is about 750 west, and the current bridges end at 500 west. So you'd have between one or two blocks of extra street frontage all the way through the former railroad yard sites. And that opens up the whole 70 some odd acres of land that's there. That's seven blocks worth of new space. That's multiple street frontage areas where you can have new shops, new apartments, new everything. Just by getting rid of the big bridges and the very long ramps that have to come down after those bridges, you can really clean up the area and make it less of a maze. Get rid of a lot of the little alleyways and the one-way streets and the dead ends that make it very maze-like.
Mm. Nathan Strain, what with that 76 acres, you said the city could do whatever they wanted. What are some thoughts there? I guess there'd be homes or residences. I think one of the hopes of the city is kind of dense residential areas. I think green space as well. Give me a little overview.
Absolutely. And of course, the best factor of this space is that it is truly a blank slate. I think, of course, on the top of a lot of Utahns' minds right now is a lack of housing. So it would be ideal if this space were redeveloped to include significant amounts of housing. And back of the napkin math suggests that this amount of land could include well over 10,000 units of housing, depending on how you configure it. Single family homes would be a lot less housing. You usually don't build those near the downtown core, but you could build many, many apartment buildings with tens of thousands of units inside them. But you could also incorporate significant green space. Salt Lake City is actually pursuing what they call the Green Loop. This project is fundamentally compatible with that concept of basically a linear park that could be built either along 500 West on top of the train box or along the historic rail corridor through this newly developed 76 acres. There's truly limitless possibilities.
Christian Lenhart, the price tag for this, I'm reading $3 or $4 billion that will give anyone pause, including government officials. So what do you say about that?
Yeah, it's a very big number that was put on our project there. So in our sales pitch, or just talking to Salt Lake City about the possibilities of this, we got some buy-in from the Salt Lake City Council and also from the Department of Transportation and Development and all these different groups. They pitched in for a study by engineering firm Kimley Horn to see if the project was just as feasible as we said, because, you know, we are just citizens of Utah, Salt Lake City for me. We're concerned citizens that really just had this idea and said, we would like the city to pursue this idea, and who knows how trustworthy we are. So they had the engineers come along and see if it really is feasible. And they made some, well, in talking with the shareholders, the stakeholders in the area, they made some conservative estimates on what would take to actually make the plan feasible. So the good news is, they did say the plan is feasible. It's something that can be built. The bad news is that they put the large price tag on the project, some with contingencies that are really high, some with assumptions that I think are a little too conservative. It's possible the price can go down if certain things are rearranged in their plans. But yeah, honestly, it's a big project. There's no way around it. You know, the projects in Reno and Denver were hundreds of millions of dollars, and even though those were repaid by the impacts of the project, by the benefits of the project, they still were very big amounts to pay at the time. With inflation and with rising construction costs, we definitely certainly have crossed into the $1 billion territory at least. It is a big project, but at the same time, it's also very cheap compared to what will have to happen. We know that in the future, the great separations will have to happen downtown. There's no way around it. The amount of rail traffic going through those crossings is very large now, above average, and it's going to get even more. Grade separating them one by one, it will come in small bits and pieces, but in total, that's going to cost a lot more than doing it once the right way. The economic impacts of keeping the east and west sides divided, that's going to, that comes with the price too. And the lost opportunity of, you know, the 70 some odd acres of potential housing, all the revenue that could provide to the city that would never materialize if we don't do something like the Rio Grande plan. So we can see that, the price is high right now, but the price can be repaid if we do things the right way. And that will avoid future costs. It will produce current and future incomes for the city. And overall, I think it will be a high price tag, but well spent.
I want to follow up with you, Christian, just briefly here. What's been the experience then in Denver and Reno? The project paid for itself over time, did it? Was it successful financially?
I would say so. Yeah, in Reno, the main problem that the city was facing is that the tracks were in the immediate downtown area, and Reno is famous for its casinos and people being able to go from one to the other. And they couldn't do that when freight trains were actively stopping in the streets and blocking crossings. And so you can just look at the economic returns from Reno and see that businesses are still in business, and people are still moving to the city and living there. Denver's is much more easily quantifiable, just because they had a specific project area, the 19 acres that used to be empty industrial areas, empty rail yards. If you look at the area around Denver Union Station now, it's filled with high-rises and apartments and offices. The project there cost $500 million. This was about 15 years ago as that price was put in. The amount of economic activity is $3.5 billion. That's how much was invested by the private entities that invested in the area. That's a return on investment of about 700%. It's significant amount. When you create the opportunities for business to succeed, they will, especially in high demand markets like downtown Denver and downtown Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City isn't quite as big as Denver is, but you know, with all the investment going on with the sports arenas and with the Green Loop and the Olympics arriving and all the new hotels and convention spaces that are going to be created, it's a very, very productive market, and it's going to need that extra space to continue growing. So, it's a pretty clear picture that these projects do pay for themselves in the long run, and often in just the medium run as well.
Nathan Strain, Christian mentioned Olympics. I want to ask you, Nathan, about that. I imagine there's hope that there might be special investment because the Olympics are coming, and maybe some of that could go to this project.
Absolutely. The Olympics are coming in 2034, which is, as of now, a little less than 10 years away. That seems like a lot of time. For a big infrastructure project, that is a very, very short amount of time. Similarly priced freeway projects in the state typically take around 30 years in the planning and development stages. Now, of course, we believe that the unique circumstances and the unique return opportunities of this project warrant it to be sped up. So for the Olympics coming to town, the sort of compressed timeline of how this will work is that the city will be studying the East-West Divide for the next 2 years. And if it takes another 2 years to sort of quantify funding and find out the, you know, work out the last engineering details and such, the city's study estimates this project will take 5 years to build. That's 9 years, but it could be done before the Olympics. It's worth noting that leading up to 2002, around 1997, the Utah Department of Transportation did 15 years of interstate reconstruction in 3 years. And that inflation adjusted value is about $3.6 billion. So not far off from the cost of our project. So with the Olympics coming, of course, projects have the potential to be accelerated. There's potential for significant federal funding. And of course, this is a pressing problem that just has to be solved. So the dominoes are sort of just lined up perfectly right now for this project.
Kristen Lindhar, where are you with this? I guess you engaged the city, right? Where are you with government engagement? And I guess you've had some studies. What's next, I guess, is where I'm going with this.
Yeah, so we spent a couple years talking with as many public officials as we could. It's hard to contact people from all these government agencies when you are just a private concerned citizen. But we've been slowly making our connections and speaking with everyone we can. Salt Lake City applied for and won a grant from the Federal Transportation Department. Worth $2 million about, it's called a Reconnecting Communities Study. And this is a pretty major study that will involve lots of different engineering firms lots of periods of civic engagement so that engineers and citizens can talk about what to do about East-West connections. The focus of the study will be building better East-West connections by making transportation improvements, whether that's new bridges, or whether that's something to address the freeway, or whether it's the Rio Grande plan. I personally was invited to write a letter of support for this grant application, which is just one of the surreal things that happens when you get involved in these things. You know, being personally asked to write a letter to transportation secretaries and federal officials asking for these funds. So this study is kicking off early next year, January-ish, and the study is going to run for about 2 years. We're slowly building up our volunteer organization so that when it's time for the public to talk to the engineers, that we will have people aware of what the study is, and also primed so that if they know about the Rio Grande plan, they're able to talk about it and let the city officials know that that is what they want. And hopefully in 2 years, we will have a verdict from the study that says the Rio Grande plan is the preferred way, not just by the engineers, but also by the citizens, of how to fix the issues in their city. And once that's done, we will have a federally backed study in support of us. We'll have the Olympics coming. We'll have hopefully a lot more public officials able to share their opinion publicly in support of the Rio Grande plan. And we think, just like Nathan said, that yeah, at that point, the dominoes will be ready to be tipped and we can expect amazing things. Whether we get it done by the Olympics or not, that's an open question. But I think everyone's really hoping that it is. Like last time, we built extra freeways, and those were very needed. It was a good project at the time. It's just, how do we define our city and our state this time? Last time we built freeways, this time we can build transit. Last time we focused on cars, this time we can focus on public spaces and urban integration and sustainability. It just sends such a great message to who we are as Utahns, what we value as we welcome the world.
As we wrap up the conversation here, Nathan Strain, I guess I'll give you the last word. How do people engage? Where do they find more information? If people want to kind of get on board and push this, or I guess register objections, where can they go?
We have our website is riograndplansaltlakecity.org. We have a contact us form, and yeah, we want to hear it all. If you want to support us, if you want to help us, we want to hear it. If you have comments or concerns, we want to hear those too. We also have social media. We're on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and of course we're all volunteers, so we may take a few hours or days to get back to you, but we do try to respond to everybody who contacts us. And of course, everyone needs to keep their ears ready for the Salt Lake City Reconnecting Community Study to kick off, which will involve a lot of public engagement. I should also quickly add that we did receive the endorsement of the Salt Lake County Council a couple of months ago. So this project is real. It is in the public sphere. It's absolutely, it's a real concept. And now we just have to push it just a little further to be a reality.
All right. Well, thanks for telling us about this. We've been talking with a couple of representatives from the group Via Rio Grande. They're proposing this vision for removing railroad crossings, revitalizing the neighborhood, reusing the historic Rio Grande Depot, Salt Lake City's main transit hub, many other aspects of this. You can find out more about this at the website riograndplanssaltlakecity.org, riograndplanssaltlakecity.org. We've been talking with Christian Lennart from Via Rio Grande. Christian, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And Nathan Strain, also from Via Rio Grande. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll go to a break. And when we come back, we'll have our usual Leo T and Sky Watcher. Thanks, everybody.
It's One Sky Many Cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here as we go into the evening and night sky after the incredible fall we're having. Some well-known constellations rotate into good view during November evenings. Aries the Ram. It's low in the east at nightfall, marked by its two brightest stars, Hamal and Sheraton. Auriga follows it. The Charioteer is easy to spot because it's home to Capella. I keep mentioning Capella. It's one of the brighter stars. Venus is the evening star this month in the west above the horizon. And on the other side of the sky in the east, Jupiter, the second brightest point of light in the night sky, peeking into view in the east-northeast by early evening. Mars is also in view by midnight, shining bright orange. The full moon of November on the 15th is known as the frost moon or snow moon. Also keep looking into deep space up in the mountains or desert or in the ocean or get behind a pine tree in your cemetery or your park. Star clusters line up in the evening at this time like pearls on a necklace. The highlight is the double cluster or the crystalline Marge Simpson head, as it looks to me, a close pair of clusters in Perseus. Also going on, the Taurid meteor showers kicking in. An illustration of the sky throughout November 24 shows the peak of the northern Taurid meteor shower originating from Taurus, the constellation. There's an image there. Credit to Chris Vaughn and Starry Night. For the next week or so, if you happen to be outside during the overnight hours and happen to catch a glimpse of the bright and colorful shooting stars, possibly a Taurid meteor you're seeing. The annual meteor display shows up every year between the middle of October and the middle of November, but November 5th through the 12th would be the best time to look for them. There are 8 to 12 an hour. It's the slowest moving meteorites, which should make for great viewing when you find a few, some colorful ones. The Taurid meteor shower is highest after midnight, so the shower can be observed all night if you're out in the darkness and you can find it. The name, of course, comes from the way they mostly radiate from the constellation Taurus the Bull, which sits low in the east a couple of hours after sundown and is almost directly overhead by about 1:30 a.m. By the morning of November 12th, it will be up till about 2:30 a.m., so then you'll have the rest of the night to look for meteors. And from Today in Space History with Hanukkah Waitering, NASA and the Soviet Space Program, Laika, the Soviet dog, was a stray dog recruited to be launched on November 3rd, 1957. Probably part Husky or Nordic breed, possibly Samoyed and Terrier. She was calm and got along with other dogs and looked happy and sweet in the pictures from the Soviet Space Program and NASA that you can see on the Skywatcher Facebook page, thanks to the Soviets and NASA. She was the first animal to orbit the Earth and made it around the Earth 4 times on Sputnik 2. That was somewhat on the heels of Sputnik 1. The small satellite launched the space program and scared a few people, I guess. Before any humans, she got there. She died from overheating or hypothermia in space capsule. They didn't have a heat shield designed for her to even come down, so they kind of knew she was going to be an experimental dog. You can see pictures of Laika the space dog on the Skywatcher Facebook page. I'm proposing a new constellation for all the animals in space led by Laika. There's dragons, whales, and bears hanging in the stars, but this is for animals that got launched into space, you know, monkeys and whatever else. In the east-southeast, the Sirius, the dog star, is actually orbited by a dwarf star that orbits every 50 years. That's in the Big Dog constellation. In Native American lore, Cherokees saw two bright stars in Canis Major, the Big Dog, as the Great Dog, as two dogs guarding the path to the land of the souls. So let's make that constellation for Laika. It's up to us. Let's honor the dog in space. Let's choose some stars up there in the sky. Other constellations or asterisms or patterns in the space are the coat hanger, which looks very much like a coat hanger hanging high in the Milky Way in the summer by Delphinius, told to me by two grade school girls and their mother as I was a park ranger at Capitol Reef in the dark. You have to grab the telescope for this one, but I'll show you where it is. I was excited to see this and learn this. Now, the space dog Laika will take a little thought. If you want to engage, please send your thoughts or suggestions to Skywatcher Leo T Facebook page, or after visiting this one, visiting with some interesting folks at Dick and Dixie's in the Snowstorm neighborhood pub, one of the sky myths Madeline came up with is that David Bowie met Laika in space and took her up to the stars and the Milky Way. I kind of like that one. We'll find a place in the stars for Laika. So keep looking up, look around, write some stories. Skywatcher Leo T.